Mining Museum. Welcome to the Montecatini Val di Cecina Mining Documentation and Reference Centre. This historical building, once the town hall from 1500 to 1950, houses a collection of information about the subterranean resources present in the Cecina Valley, which have been exploited throughout the centuries. The first room displays documents and images of the copper mine in Montecatini. In the centre of the room stands a hypothetic reconstruction of the mine shaft and some original items, such as an anvil, a key specifically made for an unknown piece of machinery, gear moulds that were cast in iron at the mine's foundry, and more. Starting from the right-hand side of the room, there is an interesting fresco depicting mother and child and panels displaying some examples of the minerals that were once extracted. Child copyright, bornite, chalcocite, etc. The historical images of the buildings help us to understand the entity of the mining industry. If you have already visited the mining area, you will have an idea of the mining complex as it looks today and as it once was. If not, do remember these images when you visit the mine. The panels tell the story of the 80-year development of the mine, from the production to the topology of the excavation and extraction. Only a few of the ledgers and samples of minerals have been put on display, as the main collection is to be found in the mining archives here in the Documentation Centre. The last two panels tell the story of the social aspect of the mine and the demographic development of the town. You probably didn't know anything about this mine until you came in, but it will undoubtedly leave a strong impression. In 1800, the social benefits provided to the miners and their families are probably unthinkable in today's reality. As you walk out of the room and climb the stairs, you will notice a plumb line used to build the mine shafts, and the tags show the names of the 10 levels of the Capurciano or Montecatini mine. In the first small room, you will find information about other copper mines in the Cecina Valley, in Libiano, Micciano and Montecastelli, which was successfully exploited when the mine in Montecatini flourished. The owner and managing director of the Montecatini mine was the one who opened the Montecastelli mine. Difficult to reach and now an integral part of the landscape, the only way of visiting the ruins of these mines is on foot along the country trails. If you are interested in visiting them, consult the geosite map at the bottom of the stairs. Now let's go into the room dedicated to rock salt. About 6 million years ago, this area was under the sea until the waters evaporated, leaving great quantities of subterranean rock salt, later covered over by clay sediments. The rock salt deposits lay at a depth of between 300 and 1,000 metres. The extraction of the salt dates back to the Middle Ages, clearly seen in a painting displayed in a church in Volterra, depicting donkeys laden with sacks of salt. There is no documented evidence of salt extraction during the Etruscan and Roman eras, but it is not to be excluded. In the 18th century, the Grand Duchy salt works were established, and in 1919, the Solvay Company began to extract the salt for industrial use, producing soda. Today, the salt is extracted by dissolution. Fresh water is pumped into the supply shafts for as long as it takes to dissolve the salt. The brine is then pumped to the surface, brought to the salt works in Saline, where it is recrystallized into table salt or pumped to Rosignano Solvay for the production of soda. The panels show historical photographs of the supply shafts at the beginning of the 20th century and the environmental impact on the landscape, which is prevented nowadays. The showcase displays the cube-shaped rock salt crystals and the chalk crystals, which form in the pipelines carrying the brine. The next room, dedicated to alabaster, has been kindly granted by the Alabaster Eco Museum in Volterra. On entering, on the right, are drawings of the recent geological history of the Cecina Valley, where you can observe the various phases of the flooding of the area. The first phase shows a lake, and probably due to tectonic subsidence, the lake was invaded by the sea. Then high evaporation occurred, probably due to the rising of the threshold link with the open sea, and everything dried out. During the water evaporation, layers of calcite, chalk, and rock salt were deposited. Alabaster is in fact a microcrystalline chalk, formed in ovular blocks within the chalk layers. The first showcase on the left displays a collection of the different varieties of alabaster, each with their own specific features and colouring, depending on the absorption of the inclusions. The other showcases display some artifacts from various eras. The translucent quality of the stone has always favoured the manufacture of lamps. On the right, there is an Etruscan urn, by courtesy of the Etruscan Museum, a testimony that the ancient Etruscans were the first to sculpt alabaster. The last panel on the right displays a picture of the great traveller Giuseppe Viti, who traded alabaster throughout the world in the 19th century, a period of great prosperity for the alabaster craft. In the 20th century, and particularly in the 70s, the production became almost exclusively industrial, and consequently experienced a strong decline, which has continued to this very day. The Alabaster Eco Museum in Volterra tells the story of the alabaster craft, from the excavation of the stone to its production and marketing. Let's move into the room dedicated to the geothermal energy. For further information, visit the Geothermal Museum in Lardarello and the natural emissions in Sasso Pisano and Monte Rotondo Marittimo. The panels on the right explain how a geothermal field is formed. Magma, found at a depth from 9 to 12 kilometres below ground, heats the layers of impermeable rock. A water table, continuously fed by rainwater, flows through the overlaying strata of permeable rock. This water is heated by the magma below, and as it is covered by a layer of impermeable rock, the vapour formed remains under pressure. The vapour can only reach the surface through cracks in the earth's crust or by drilling down to the geothermal fluid. The showcase displays some machinery from the old power plant in Lardarello and some minerals linked to geothermal activity, such as sulphur, sassolite, chalk and calcite scaling deposits. The panel facing the door displays a fragment of the tabula Putingeriana, an ancient Roman military map in which you can read Acque Volterrane e Popolonie, the two thermal bathhouses once present in the area of Lardarello during the Etruscan and Roman eras. Let's now go through to the room dedicated to chalcedony. If you look into the showcase, there are some splendid examples of this mineral. Chalcedony is found here due to the hot water probably linked to geothermal phenomena on the serpentine rocks. In fact, when serpentine comes into contact with corrosive hot water, it decomposes, forming magnesite and silica, which in microcrystalline form are known as chalcedony. Chalcedony is, in fact, a microcrystalline quartz. That is why it is so hard and resistant. In the past, it was used in intarsia, a typical Florentine art in the 1500s, in the precious stone factory in Florence. You can still see how these rocks were cut and selected. In the Cecina Valley, chalcedony is mostly found in the area of Montirufoli, whose quarries were once renowned for the mineral's violet tones of colour. The last room, not always open to the public, is a conference room. The panels on the right display samples of green rocks and sedimentary rocks. The panels between the windows tell the story of two other mines found in the Cecina Valley, the Solfatara and the Lignite mines. The Lignite mine, situated in the magnificent countryside at Villetta Montirufoli, has a fascinating story. To transport the lignite from this isolated spot, a rail track was built to link the mine directly to the station in Cassino di Terra, which functioned from 1870 to 1928. In order to build the tracks, the rocky land was cut into. Embankments and bridges were constructed, many of which can still be seen spanning the Ritasso torrent. The formation of lignite in the Cesena Valley is linked to the geological epoch between the lake and sea, where marshes were formed in some areas, favouring the deposit of and the subsequent fossilisation of plant material. The mine. Welcome to the Montecatini Copper Mine. Thanks to the municipal administration of Montecatini Val di Cesena and contributions offered by the Upper Cesena Valley Comunità Montana, the province of Pisa, the region of Tuscany and the European Union, the abandoned mine has been turned into a museum. The visit to the mining museum will be led by one of our guides, but this audio guide will give you more information. We are starting from the last room to the right of the entrance. This room displays some reproductions of original documents from 1800, like the large plan on the floor of the vertical and horizontal layout of the mine. The plan shows the main shaft, the Alfredo shaft, which reached a depth of 315 metres and the subdivision of the mine into 10 levels, with galleries branching off on each level. The total sum of the lengths of the galleries measures 35 kilometres and the total sum of the height of all the shafts 10 kilometres. A panel situated in the right-hand corner displays a lithograph depicting the miners carrying oil lamps and dressed in everyday clothing. The rail cars laden with extracted minerals were pushed by hand along the tracks running through the galleries. The galleries were reinforced with wooden planks when they were only operated for a short period of time. For a longer period, the galleries were reinforced in masonry or iron rods and wooden planks. The panel to the right of the door shows the machinery in the washery, a place where the ore is freed from impurities by washing. The minerals extracted in this mine were mainly copper ores and sulfides, such as bornite, Schall copperite, and chalcocite, which are sources of copper. The copper ores were sorted, while the sulfides were crushed, washed in large rotating cylinders, and then sorted for size and weight, while the waste was taken to the tip, which is still visible at the end of the car park beyond the two cypress trees. The sale of the minerals took place every first Monday of the month, and the buyers that mostly came from England, together with the sellers, carried out an analysis of a sample of the mineral to evaluate the copper content, and according to the value of copper on the London Stock Exchange, a price was established. The copper was then packed in vats, transported on wagons to Vada, loaded onto boats to Livorno, where the vats were transferred onto ships to England, and the direct delivery to the factories. This mine only sold ore. The separation process took place in foundries far from here. If you stay a little longer after the guided visit, you can read the other panels that tell the story of the mine and information about copper mining in Europe. Now we will move towards the entrance and go down the stairs. Here you can observe the symbol of the Montecatini mine, two crossed-over work tools, a symbol of the work itself, surmounted by a Venus mirror, which commemorates the ancient origins of Roman copper mining on the island of Cyprus, thus the name of copper in Latin, cuprum. Mythology tells the story of Venus being born in the waters of Cyprus, hence the connection between the image and the name of the mineral. In the entrance there are several marble and terracotta busts depicting main characters of the story of this mine. The first owner, a Frenchman, Louis Portet, who opened the mine in 1827. A German gentleman, August Schneider, who managed the mine for 45 years, and his successor and son, Harold, who managed the mine for 12 years. The Dutch brothers Kleiber, the Russian Count Dmitry Butalinye, who inherited the property from the British geologist Sloane, a close friend of the Grand Duke. We can also read the list of eminent people who have visited the mine. On the top of the list, the names of various Grand Dukes of Tuscany, the Archbishop of Westminster, and the Thergioni Tozzetti, the first discoverers of the copper reserves. Copper has been extracted in this area since the Etruscan era, although what we are looking at today dates back to 1800. The mine was closed down in 1907 due to the slump in the price of copper. The last company to own the mine from 1888 was an Italian company, the Montecatini Spa, that eventually merged with the Edison Company, the origins of the renowned Montedison, an important chemical giant in Italy during the last century. The miners entered the mine in teams, first stopping at the small window near the door to leave their medals bearing their serial number, which were collected at the end of an 8-hour shift. This was a safety precaution, for if a medal was left at the end of a shift, it was known who exactly needed to be rescued. With our helmets on, we can now proceed into the mine. Above the entrance, there is an encouraging inscription that reads, "You are my God, and my life is in your hands." Mining has always been the most dangerous job in the world, and many miners relied on divine protection. The miners had to respect very strict rules and regulations, one of which was never to shout or whistle in the mine. Perhaps we ought to respect them too. Ready? Let's go in. As you can see, the gallery is clad with masonry. Both the mortar and the bricks, baked in the kilns within the mining area, were made by the miners themselves. The ceramic lunette, depicting the Madonna of Caporciano, dating back to 1800, was originally placed above a small altar at a depth of 120 metres, so that the miners could say a prayer before venturing deeper into the mine. The lamp hanging up was the latest kind used in the mine, an acetylene gas lamp used in the Tuscan countryside up until the last century. A white powder, carbide, was placed in the can, and the water above it, regulated by a valve, gradually dripped onto the powder, creating a chemical reaction, producing highly inflammable acetylene gas, which fed the flame to produce an adequate source of light. We are now entering the entrance gallery, Luisa, a standard size gallery of 140 by 220 metres. Looking down at the stair shaft gives us an idea of what it must have been like to descend into the mine. The 249 steps, which reach down to a depth of 120 metres, are still intact, but obviously not open to the public. At a depth of 150 metres, there is a water table. When the mine was operative, the miners were able to extract the minerals only thanks to the steam pumps that aspirated the water directly from the water table. In fact, more than half the mine is below the water table, and in order to remove this enormous quantity of water, which would have impeded the extraction of the minerals, a drainage gallery more than a kilometre long was built. Today, the municipal pipelines run through this very same gallery and supply the households in Montecatini with running water directly from the mine. Steam and damp often rises up the stair shaft, and as you go down, and you can feel the temperature increasing by 3 degrees every 10 meters as you get closer to the earth's crust, and often you can actually feel the hot air rising from below. The steps, although made from rock excavated from the mine, have a completely different appearance, as the stone was chiselled on the surface and then brought down to the mine. Let's climb the steps and go into the whale's belly. Walking through, you can see that this gallery has been reinforced with iron ribs and wooden planks. The basalt rock appears, which has been excavated since antiquity, and on your left, you will notice that some of the gallery openings have been completely filled in with boulders. This method was used when the gallery was no longer operative and provided a high level of safety against eventual subsidence. Throughout the 80 years in which the mine was operative, not one gallery actually collapsed. We are now at the Alfredo shaft. The shaft, completely reinforced in masonry, is rectangular in shape, although lower down it is probably elliptical and not reinforced. The water flowing from this level is a vein pouring out 7 liters per second and was undoubtedly ducted when the mine was operative. In the summer, it tends to completely dry up. On the other side of the shaft, there was the hopper, a funnel-shaped reservoir from which the minerals were discharged down a chute, automatically loading the tubs, which were hoisted up to the surface. As it is dangerous to proceed any further into the mine, we will conclude our visit here and go back from where we came. Let's go outside now into the washery area. Most of the buildings are no longer standing, and all the machinery was either taken to other mines or sold as old iron. We can still see the areas where the chutes used to lean up against the side of the slope, making the most of the force of gravity to slide the minerals down. We can also see some worked stones which have been specifically placed to show us where some of the machinery originally stood, and a hopper that still preserves the grid with oxide mineral deposits. In the courtyard at the entrance to the mine stands a large cone-shaped stone. This is a pillow basalt, a volcanic rock typical of this mining area. In fact, basalt deposits, both in compact or pillow form, can be seen over an area of 2 square kilometres. 150 million years ago, the area was beneath an ocean, and on the ocean bed there were volcanoes, as there are today in the central part of the Atlantic Ocean. When basalt erupts underwater, contact with the water quenches the surface, and the lava forms a distinctive pillow shape, through which the hot lava breaks to form another pillow. This underwater eruption environment also seems to be how the copper was formed in this area. Now, let's go up to the first floor of the mine entrance. These rooms have been renovated and furnished with the original furniture. Here we have the administration office, the managing director's office, the technical office, and the chemical laboratory. There were not many white-collar workers, but they played a fundamental role in the managing of the mine. As we go upstairs, we pass by the old chimney stack. Only a third of the structure has survived. It was originally 71 metres high and served as a flue to the boiler room that fed the steam-run machinery in the washery. From here, we can look down and almost imagine what the surface mine once looked like. Although most of the buildings are no longer standing, we can perceive the highly skilled architectural accomplishment in the construction of the buildings for that era in the mining area. Let's proceed up the stone stairs, which will lead us to the outdoor stairs. The Alfredo Shaft. The external buildings at the Alfredo Shaft Tower were the carpentry workshops. Today the workshops are without a roof, but even so, civil weddings are celebrated and concerts are held here. The wood was stacked in the courtyard and then taken inside to be worked on steam-run saws and grinding wheels. We are now in the machinery room, the power unit for a steam hoisting machine. The winch or winding machine was operated by steam. The steam was produced by the boilers in the next room, no longer standing, where there used to be a 71 metre high chimney. The plunger set in motion the equalizer that turned the piston rod that first set in motion the flywheel, and then the gears that controlled the number of rotations that set in motion the pulleys around which the cable was wound. By rotating the wheel just once, the cable unraveled or wound, allowing the hoists to be pulled up or down the shaft. Entering the hoisting compartment, we can clearly appreciate the careful and attentive restoration work preserving what was discovered in this room. If you look up, you can see the two wheels where the cable passed through from the adjacent machinery room. The cable was lowered and a swivel hook attached to the end of the hoisting cable secured the loads. Looking down, you can see the depth of the shaft. The two hoists were raised and lowered alternately, lifting the extracting minerals to the surface and dropping working tools down into the mine. It took 6 minutes for the load to travel the 315-metre length of the shaft. At the surface, the load was tipped out onto skips that were sent to the hopper, where the minerals slid down the chute and into the washery. A bell was used to communicate down into the depths of the mine. The number of rings indicated when to raise, lower, stop, or change level. The intact mining tower, the oldest example in Europe, was purely used for industrial purposes and not for defence, despite the crenellations and sophisticated architecture. The Malakoff towers in the Ruhr in Germany, built in 1878, that are still standing, were also used for defence since they were in a border area. The Alfredo shaft was named after Alfred Hall, the owner of the mine, in 1855, the year in which this shaft became operative. Previously, the Luigi shaft, named after Louis Porte, was used and operated by horsepower. The top of the tower offers a magnificent view of the surrounding landscape. To the north, you can see Poggio ai Massi with its fire tower and the great wall of a dam, built to create the water reservoir to supply the steam for the mining machinery and the washery. To the south, we can see the mining village with all its yellow buildings, the church, the theatre, the school, the owner of the mine's mansion, the white-collar workers' homes, a small shop that provided the essentials at a low cost for the miners, a small guest house, and a surgery. As the miners either lived in the village of Montecatini or in the countryside, it was never necessary to specifically build homes for them, unlike many other mining villages that are usually situated in remote areas. Looking a little further out, you can see the medieval village of Montecatini Valdicecina, and beyond, Volterra. To the right, the woodlands of the Berignone Nature Reserve, the Rocca Silana, as far as the highest hill, Le Cornate di Gerfarco, where the sources of the Cecina River are situated. You can also see a vast area with some lakes, which is where rock salt is extracted. To conclude, just a few words about the miners and the mining community. You could start working in the mine at 12 years old, although you could not go down into the galleries until you were 18, which is rather surprising, considering the exploitation of children in all the other mines all over the world during the same era. The miners had established a mutual aid society, ancestor of today's unions, and with the money obtained through self-taxation and the company itself, they managed to pay a pension to the widows, the injured, and the sick. During the coppersmith celebration, held once a year, three dowries for the miners' daughters or sisters were drawn by lot. New development and cultural events were encouraged by the foresighted owners of the mine. The village came to life. Two theatres, a boys' school and a girls' school were built. Two musical bands were formed. A post office was established, and there was a coach service to the train station once a week. The population increased from 500 inhabitants at the beginning of the 19th century to 2,500 at the end of the same century. When the mine closed down in 1907, the mining community moved to find work elsewhere, in Tuscany and further afield in southern and northern Europe, and the number of remaining inhabitants turned back to the same amount as at the beginning of the 19th century.